Welcome to another edition of the List A Write Fiction podcast. We've got a great show for you all today about our favorite 80s albums. Before we get started, if you love the pod, please take a moment to rate, review, and subscribe on your listening app. It helps us reach new listeners like you. Also, be sure to check out our companion Spotify playlist with all our picks that we mentioned in the pod. The link is in the show details. Now, on to the show. In a lot of ways, technology helped many 80s pop stars to explode. From the gated reverb drum sound, think Phil Collins' 1981 song In the Air Tonight, or Prince's 1986 song Kiss, to the Yamaha DX7 keyboard synthesizer, think Berlin's 1986 song Take My Breath Away from the Top Gun soundtrack, or Tina Turner's 1983 hit What's Love Got to Do With It, to the Roland TR-808 drum machine. Think Whitney Houston's 1987 pop hit, I Want to Dance with Someone, or Marvin Gaye's 1982 song, Sexual Healing. This new technology gave the 80s such a huge and identifiable sound. Coupled with the rise in popularity of music videos, these sounds became inescapable, and it seemed that it was a requirement for any artist of the time to incorporate these sounds. Sometimes for the worse. Think Chicago's 1984 tune, Hard Habit to Break. However, some artists of the era took these new tools and really did amazing things with them, creating memorable albums that are loved well beyond the 80s bubble where they became popular. These are the albums we'll discuss today as we discuss our favorite 80s albums and why we love them. So hang out with us for a bit and see if our list matches yours. And with that, on to the show. We got Freddie Berman.
Hey.
Adam Zielinski.
Hello.
Me. That's me. Brendan McGeehan.
Hey, hey.
And that's the show. And let's get into it. Let's get into it. Freddie.
Yes.
Give me your first 80s album pick.
Okay, so my first 80s album pick was technically released in the fall of 79.
Breaking the mold.
Already.
Great start.
Yeah. Sorry, but the Police's second studio album, Regatta de Blanc. And apparently, the loosely translated album title means white reggae, so I guess that's appropriate for that band.
Yeah, pretty appropriate.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I love the Police. What can I say? You know, to me, they were the Beatles of the 80s, if I can be so sacrilege. and they were kind of the band, and even though they got their start in the late 70s, they were kind of the band that shook it up for me a little bit. I'd kind of lost hope, you know, with any new music coming out. I guess, I don't know, some of the Clash, I like some of that. But as far as rock-oriented music, they lifted the bar a little high. And, sure? Yeah, that album is great. A lot of great tunes. Message in a Bottle, Bring on the Night, Walking on the Moon, Bed's Too Big Without You. I mean, they're all great songs. And I guess due to the fact that it was at the end of the 70s, beginning of the 80s, it's more about them playing as opposed to the technological aspect of it.
Sure.
And that's my first pick.
Great pick. Adam, what's yours?
All right. I just want to comment on that Police album. Given that there was the media drip of the time, and there was no Spotify to get albums immediately, there's a fair chance most people did not ingest that until 1980 anyway. So I'm going to let this one slide.
I'm thinking the same.
Yeah. And my first choice, I went with Elvis Costello's Imperial Bedroom. You know, in the 80s, I mean, Elvis Costello was that late 70s angry young man, you know, riding that new wave, some great albums there. But I think in the 80s, he kind of started showing he was more than just this one note angry young man, as I said. In Imperial Bedroom, he has a Jeffrey Emmerich on there, helping him out, who did, I was engineered a lot of the Beatles sessions. You can tell there's kind of a, I mean, through Elvis Costello's career, he's taken a lot of different turns, but I feel like this one, and this is from like, I believe 82. Yes. 1982. This is a very accessible one stylistically. It's not too aggressive. It's not too sparse. I think it's kind of got that, it does have that kind of a Beatles-y glow to it. Just as far as like the production value of it. But, I love this album. I saw him at Central Park a few years ago in a like anniversary tour of this. He's still got it. And then, but this is my, my choice for, number three.
Thank you, Adam. And, I'm going to go right now and give my number three pick. My number three 80s album pick is a guy named Joe Jackson with his album Night and Day, released in 1982. I love this album. I don't love any other Joe Jackson album ever, but this album, for some reason, it just hits on so many levels, rhythmically, lyrically. Sonically, it just makes me feel like I'm walking in, you know, 1981, New York City. Just the way it's like, you know, the way he presented it, the way the musicians and the music comes together. And a couple key tracks are, you know, Stepping Out, which is was a really big hit back then. The first track on the album, Another World. If you listen to that that song, the rhythm and the groove on that with the piano and percussion is just amazing. And then probably what made me love this album the most was the song, there's a song called TV Age, and he has a lyric, you know, the force has got a lot of power. What makes you think it gives a shit about you? Who are you anyway? And that was a reference to Michael Jackson, and I just thought that was so incredible. So that is my
wow
number three album from the 80s. And now on to you, Brandon.
Thanks, Aaron, for the handoff. My number three is Herbie Hancock's Future Shock, which may come as a shock to any of you. Haha. And when you announced
that, you had that ready.
I swear I didn't. I'm cringing at myself for saying it. Anyway, when it was announced that we were going to do 80s albums this week, I couldn't, that was the first one that came to mind. It is 80s AF, as the kids say. They say that, right? Isn't that what they say? It's just the textures of it, the drum machines, the synthesizers, the keytar, everything about it sounds so 80s to me, but I love it. It's like just the production quality is just so embracing the times. Oh man, all of it. Talk about Rocket. Like, how about the music video for Rocket? It was on MTV.
The video. Great. It was
amazing.
Great.
Yeah. Which I only just found out in like looking up some info about the record. That music video was directed by Godley and Cream, the 10cc guy.
Oh yeah.
They
didn't know that.
They had a big video production company. Yep.
Right. So I love it. And the cover of the Curtis Mayfield Future Shock, the album title is way cool. And it's just so embracing the 80s. I couldn't think of a better choice.
Right on.
Good pick. Freddie, man, you're up.
All right. My next pick is Peter Gabriel's 1986 release, So.
Yeah.
Actually, one of the first Peter Gabriel albums that actually had a title, because they were all self-titled, I think, up until that
one through
point.
Four, yeah.
And man, this record... Every single song, Red Rain, Sledgehammer, Don't Give Up, That Voice Again, In Your Eyes, Mercy Street, Big Time. I mean, every song is great.
Great hits. Yep.
Amazing. Yeah. And the playing is great. And, you know, you got Kate Bush as a featured guest. Just a really groundbreaking album to me in terms of performance, songwriting, Fairlight synthesizer being used. Manu Katché and Stuart Copeland from The Police, I believe, did the hi-hat overdub on Red Rain. That's all he played was hi-hat.
He did a good job.
Gabriel liked it. Yeah.
Wow.
So, that's my number two. Jerry Murata and Tony Levin. Let us not forget.
Tony Levin forever.
Yep.
Quick note on that one, on that pick. My partner and I, we actually saw Peter Gabriel do that album at the Wells Fargo Center a couple years ago. And we were in the nosebleed section, but it was tremendous. Like, those songs hold up in a live setting so many years later. And Peter Gabriel is still a master.
Was that with the strings? Was that the thing he did with the strings or no?
I can't remember. I know there was a lot of people there on stage there. I don't know if it was the strings or not, but it was a lot of people up there. Oh, yeah, I think it might have been, because he did like a stripped down version, like with him and the piano. And then he did, then he played the album. It was tremendous. Anyway, that's something else. But go ahead, Adam. Go with the, what's your next pick, man?
Well, before I get to that, I have to say, just as I got ahead of Freddie on Joni Mitchell, Freddie got ahead of me on Peter Gabriel. I am a massive Peter Gabriel.
And me too.
I am such a big Peter Gabriel fan. I have the Passion soundtrack on vinyl. That's how big of a Peter Gabriel fan I am. And, but for, anywho, my number two is, I go with, Roxy Music's Avalon, which, for those of you that know Roxy Music, you know, I mean, Eno early on, and, you know, they were kind of like the, you know, one of the earlier glam bands. Then after a hiatus, they came back and is more just kind of Brian Ferry's baby at the time. But Avalon, like, you know, when we're talking 80s albums, Avalon sounds as 80s as you can get, but in like the perfect way, I think. It's just great songwriting, great sounds. It's just got that really soft, seductive feeling to it. I'm just completely enamored with this album. I know a lot of people that are huge fans of it. I just saw he was at the Met last year, doing like a tour in support, you know, in support of the anniversary of Avalon. I guess that's a theme for at least my first two picks here. And just, I mean, he's not quite, he didn't quite have what he did back in the day, but he had such a great band and they put on such a great show. And I just, I mean, it's like Avalon for me is like a bonus Roxy Music album, because I love their earlier stuff, and this is just nothing like it, but still just fantastic. Roxy Music, Avalon, numero dos.
Nice. I really appreciated the album. I never heard it, and it was
nice.
It was really, really a big treat.
Awesome.
And so yeah, I'm gonna go to my pick now. My number two 80s album pick is Control by Miss Janet Jackson. What did she say? Miss Jackson, if you're nasty or something. Anyway, something like that. Anyway, the album is her third studio album, came out in 1986. And she recorded it with the super producers, Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis. I believe it was her first album that she did with them. And it's basically the album that kind of put her on the pop map. She released the album before this, which was it was kind of a hodgepodge of disco-y and just bad songs. But this one really just popped, you know, for her, with the key tracks of When I Think of You and The Pleasure Principle and Nasty and just, you know, Let's Wait a While. You know, I would listen to that song and it'd be like, yeah, it's okay. I really haven't crossed that threshold. Yeah, it's okay. back when I was a teenager. But that's my number two pick. And that's my number two pick. Now let's go to Brendan.
Cool. I am going to go to 1989 for my number two pick, and we're going with the Neville Brothers' Yellow Moon record.
Oh yeah.
And I have loved this record for a long time, and I only, in preparing for the show, realized it was from the 80s, and it was the
barely.
Same. Yeah, just barely. But still, yeah. when you listen to it through that lens, you hear a little bit of the 80s style production with the reverb use and things like that. And it came out the same year as Bob Dylan's Oh Mercy, and both were produced by Daniel Lanois. And
as is so.
Right. Yeah. We've got the Lanois thread going on.
Yeah,
and I think they used the same mansion in New Orleans that they rented out and set up a studio in, which again, just, we talked about that a few episodes back with the Dylan record, but just sounds like such an amazing way to make a record. That sounds so fun. But anyway, back to Yellow Moon. I've loved this record for a long time, and I think the sequencing of it is amazing. I love how it can go from like the most tender Aaron Neville ballad to like a New Orleans party track to track. And so you've got the full range of that. They've got the Dirty Dozen horns on there. They've got amazing covers of Change Is Gonna Come. They've got a Dylan cover on there. It just has something for everyone. And that's why it's my number two.
Excellent, man. Excellent. Hey, Freddie, what's your last pick there, buddy?
I just want to add that I wore that Neville Brothers album out.
Yeah.
It's still a go-to from time to time. It's a great album. My Blood, great song.
Yeah.
You know. All right. My third and final pick, and like I said in the past, I usually don't like to rate them 3-1, 1-3, whatever. In terms of commercial success, this is probably the epitome of 80s record buying would be Michael Jackson's Thriller, which, by the way, was his sixth studio solo album. And probably to a lot of people, it's his first. You know what I mean?
Yeah, sure.
Or a second.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What, after Ben?
I wasn't thinking, I was thinking more off the wall, but I mean,
oh, off sure. the wall. That's right. That's right.
But sure.
This, but this sure. was the epitome. Ben. This is like, I mean, I remember where I was the first time I heard Billie Jean and the bass and drums kicked in, and just sonically, it was high art.
Absolutely. Yeah, it really was.
Absolutely. The pinnacle of record.
Hey, I gotta ask you, Freddie. Did you learn how to moonwalk?
At one point, yeah, but I forgot.
Well, we're gonna have a follow up video for that.
No,
is there a VHS of that anywhere?
But just the only way I did it to embarrass myself in front of my kids. That was about it. who were very young at the time and don't remember. Which is a good thing. They would be right. scarred for life. But anyway, yeah, what a great album. Yes. Want to be starting something, Beat It, Billie Jean, Girl's Mind, Human Nature, PYT, I mean, on and on.
Yeah, talk about a hit parade.
Jeez yeah. Louise.
That guy's got your Rod Temperton Heatwave connection there.
Oh, yeah.
A lot of connective tissue here today.
Yep. Lady in My Life, Rod Temperton song, and the title track, Thriller, Rod Temperton. Yep. Wow. Yeah, it doesn't get much better than that or much more 80s.
It kind of makes me also think that maybe we should revisit that songwriter thing. Maybe the song, your songwriter should have been Rod Temperton.
One of them, possibly.
Yeah. It keeps coming back like on the sly. Let's go to Adam. What's your number one pick, man?
My number one is it's an album I like. The other two albums I've known for a while, this one I've only known I've known some of the hits on it, but I never knew this as a full album until this past year, and that is Kate Bush's Hounds of Love. And just the first side, you know, if we're going side one is just all the hits everybody knows. And then side two is the conceptual suite called The Ninth Wave. It was about a person drifting alone in sea at night. And there's kind of like the whole thing about it. So cool. The album just kind of moves me. I love her voice. I love the production. A little connective tissue to So, as she was on Don't Give Up. And just, I mean, I for those that have any idea who I am, know I ingest an ungodly amount of albums all the time. And, you know, I give them all, you know, my critical ear, but this is one of the few in the last couple years that just really moved me and really like sticks with me. And we're talking 80s. This is, and again, about as, you know, much like Avalon and Thriller, just they're like perfect encapsulations of how good the 80s, you know, the 80s production at its zenith. So that's Hounds of Love, number one.
Yeah, that's another album pick when I was listening to the Spotify playlist at it. I was like, man, this is really good. And I had never really dug into her catalog except for, you know, that solo album. But this was that was a really nice album as well.
Wow, I liked it.
So let me go to my number one. My number one.
I wonder.
80s album pick.
I'm on the edge of my seat.
Maybe we should preface this with, we had a little controversy in the Write Fiction camp this week.
We had some controversy.
I didn't even think about that, honestly. Go ahead. Sorry to interrupt.
No, that's all right. That's all right. So my number one 80s album is Parade by Prince, not the other album. The other two or three or four albums that you could probably pick. My number one 80s album is Parade by Prince. It was his eighth studio album, and it was his fourth and final album to feature The Revolution as backing band. And it was also the soundtrack album to the 1986 film Under the Cherry Moon. So it was also released in 1986. That movie Under the Cherry Moon, I love it to death. It is terrible.
Horrible.
I love it to death. Black and white. It's terrible. But anyway, you know, so this on this album, he kind of moved a little bit away from the guitar and rock elements of, you know, his, you know, other big album in 84. Actually this album was like his sort of a comeback from, you know, a disappointing album that he had. I believe it was called, you know, Around the World in a Day.
Which is a great album.
Oh, it is an amazing album.
Yeah.
It's an amazing album. But anywho.
He needed a comeback from that, man. I need a comeback from that too.
Yeah, right, right. Right. And so, you know, the key track on this one, of course, is Kiss. You know, a little bit about this. It's, you know, started off as an acoustic demo. He was going to give it to this like other band, but he was like, nah, I'm going to finish this. And as he was finishing it, he, you know, basically took out the bass and put a little more guitar. And that's what it turned out to be. And when he submitted it to the record label, they were like, this is dumb. It needs a bass line. He was like, no. And so they put it out that way. And so the other key track is Sometimes Snows in April, which I don't know if anybody out there has heard the song, but that song is so it just makes me cry when I listen to that song. And it's if you think about that song in terms of the movie, it's like, why am I crying? This movie sucks so much, but I still cry. So that is my number one pick.
One quick interjection about Parade with you, Aaron. We've been collaborating almost 20 years at this point, and so I've experienced my fair share of Prince, you know, by osmosis, like it or not. And I have to say, you kept going to Parade, and I never got Parade. Maybe like 2 years ago, sticking with it, I finally got Parade. But I know maybe like a lot of people who like a certain sound of Prince, Parade is not, you know, not the cup of tea. But I tell you, you stick around it long enough, and you figure it out. It's an excellent choice, I have to say.
Thanks. And it's also a little bit odd because he adds that little French kind of like weird Frenchiness into it, which as a, you know, Francophile, I love that stuff. So,
and just the production of it, it's, you know, Prince is known for his lush productions, and this one's not quite that. And then it took a little getting an ear for it.
Right. Well, that's my pick, and we're gonna close this segment out with Brendan. Man, what's your top cat?
Yeah, well, I don't think I'll be disappointing. I am going with David Bowie's "Let's Dance" from 1983. I think this is a fantastic record. It marked a pretty big shift for him in a lot of ways. It soured the relationship with his longtime producer and friend Tony Visconti for quite a while. Because he decided to work with Nile Rodgers on this record, which I think just marked Bowie's just constant being in tune with what was popular and what was going on in the world. And Nile Rodgers was really at the top of his game at that point. Yeah. And so can you just imagine, like, you've got Nile Rodgers and Stevie Ray Vaughan on your record, like working together? That's just such strange bedfellows to me. But I also, like, in my head, I'm like, picturing the conversation that Bowie has with Nile Rodgers. He approaches him. He's like, "Darling, I want to make a dance pop record with blues guitar." And that just sounds terrible to me.
Yeah, but can you imagine Let's Dance without Stevie Ray's licks now?
It would be impossible. Yeah,
exactly. I mean,
that always makes the song for me.
Exactly.
And it works. It works on so many levels. And it's got like such great tunes, great arrangements, great production all the way around. It sounds super 80s, but I think it ages really well for me. And tons of hits. I mean, you've got Let's Dance, China Girl, Modern Love.
Yeah.
You know, the Cat People, great song. Like, it's just a really solid record.
Right on. I saw that tour. I saw that tour. I was at the Spectrum the night that they shot the video with the balloons being released.
Oh, wow.
Oh, wow.
It was a great tour. Great band.
Yeah.
Live band.
Yeah, I really, I haven't spent a lot of time with that album, but it was really, a really nice treat. I just heard the single, like, you know, the compilation albums, but it was really great. And on that note, we're going to take a short break and be back with some more discussion. Hold on, we will be back in a sec. And we are back. So we had a great time giving you guys our picks. And, you know, first I really want to go to the sound of the 80s. So the 80s were kind of defined by certain sounds, like I mentioned in the intro, with the gated reverb drum sound and the Yamaha DX7 keyboard synthesizer and the 808 drum machine. These sounds kind of really defined the era. And so Brendan here is a producer. He's a resident producer guy. Just wanted to ask you, Brendan, about how do you use these effects? Do you, when you talk with an artist or a band, do they say, "Hey, I want that 80s sound," and you just are like, "Yeah, let's put the gated reverb on that thing and just slam it out, guys." Or the nonlinear reverb or something like that.
Oh, look at you throwing out the term.
Yeah.
Yeah. We don't typically have those exact conversations. It's more like describe the sound you're going for, or sometimes there is like a record that will bring up for a reference of like, how did they get that thing? And then that's part of my job, is basically to translate what the artist is going for and to try to make that a thing on their record. But nowadays, production is so intertwined. It's like, it's not uncommon to take some 808 samples and mix it with live drums, or taking like a Roland Juno sound, a very classic synthesizer that kind of came into prominence in the 80s, and mixing that with big electric guitars or something like that. So it's all fair game now, and it's all good. And it's just all about finding what sounds cool. But a lot of those sounds and techniques from the 80s have certainly come back into style.
Big time. Mm-hmm. Big time. Yeah. A lot of the hits that you can find today have that same sort of big drum sound, or those kind of similar synth sounds.
Speaking of drums, I just want to make you aware, there's a great documentary about the 808.
Mm-hmm.
Simply titled 808.
Okay.
Really, really well worth watching it. Came out at South by Southwest in 2015.
Hmm.
So
I'll check that out.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
And so from let's start from a macro level. It's a little different than we usually do, but from a macro level, listening to all the songs and the albums that we picked on our Spotify playlist, one of the things that I took away from it was they have some really great songs and really great, you know, there's really great ideas, but a lot of it, after I was listening to like a lot of the playlists at the same time, after a while, it seemed the greatness of the songs kind of got washed away by the sameness of the production. Is that something that, say for instance, Adam, did you kind of experience that as you were listening to the kind of Spotify playlist, or, were you really able to kind of like just really hone in on like the music as opposed to the production and the production values that might be similar record to record?
It's interesting in a sense in that I think a lot of times when things, you know, when people say things sound, you know, air quote dated, you know, they mean it in kind of a negative way. And I think in a lot of the '80s were like the technology shifted so fast. Like I think after it that like the '80s was kind of like the testing grounds for a lot of different things. But unlike most people, I don't have like a negative vibe about like sounding dated in the eighties. You know what I mean? Like it doesn't, and I don't really notice much really the sameness. No, I don't really, that doesn't occur to me really on that. I just, I don't know. I think maybe 90s stuff bothers me more than 80s. If something sounds too 90s, maybe it's just with the passing of time, each previous, decade gets a little less. But to speak on a point, just to kind of expand on that just a little bit, I think what happened a lot in that era, maybe people kind of leaned on the new technology too much and maybe started to not worry about the song itself. And a great example of that, I in my opinion, is Devo, who really just were on the cutting edge of a Mark Mothersbaugh. I mean, he's had a great career outside of Devo, but like I feel like his first four albums, he really went head first and they were just kind of on the cutting edge. And really, I mean, I wasn't there at the moment, but I feel like they had a lot of fans and they were kind of felt kind of groundbreaking. But I think after they got past their first few albums, I think they started, Mothersbaugh started kind of maybe leaning on the technology too much. And maybe that's kind of, and then the songs started to suffer. Maybe is that kind of where you were kind of going with that, Aaron?
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah. Yeah. And actually, I want to go to you, Freddie, real quick. So were you recording in that kind of time frame, that time period, when like all these kind of new sounds were coming up and coming out? And if so, like, do you have any experiences through that or no?
Yes and no. I mean, I started recording as a teenager in the 70s. My good friend of mine, a bass player, and I were songwriting partners, and we used to go into the studio every Sunday and record what we had written during the week. And so I saw the technology change, you know, as we started doing it little by little.
So when they put that gated drum sound on your kit, were you like, F you guys. Give me that disco hi-hat.
Well, you know, it's funny you should mention that because they were actually doing that live too. Oh, it wasn't just in the studio. Ooh. That was the sound live. Yikes. And it just, after a while, it just wore on your ears. Like you were tired orally.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Hey, you are.
Yes, correct. Thank you, Adam. But yeah, I saw it coming. I saw that whole thing happen, you know, to the point where, you know, this studio that we went to, the drum kit that I played on had rototoms as toms, and it sounded great. I'll send you guys some stuff, but I mean, it could have been, a wood piece of wood, because after a while we were recording on, we using Simmons drums, which, you know, I'm convinced kind of helped contribute to two things, two itises, tendonitis and tinnitus, or tinnitus, as people call it. Yeah, the technology was a good thing and a bad thing at the same time. It was the best of times, the worst of times. Yes, absolutely. I was happy to see it come back to natural sounds. Because, in the 70s, you had head drums with no heads on the bottom, and then 80s gated drums or gated whatever bureau or grated piece of wood. It didn't matter. Back to more natural sounds, which is, yes,
it's where it's. Sorry, Freddie.
No, I'm done. I'm done. What were you going to say?
I was going to say, it's funny you say that about reproducing those sounds live, because as someone who did not grow up making music in the 80s, whenever there have been a few times I can remember of playing venues and meeting the sound engineer, and they may have been of a certain age, and you do sound check and everything has that sound.
Oh yeah.
Yes. Oh yes.
Oh yeah.
I've experienced that too. And it's like, dude, no, turn that down.
Right.
Oh yeah.
Absolutely.
I think we're all in agreement.
Brendan, I just kind of want to stay on this for one more second. So looking at your pigs, I remember actually before we started this, you said that, you know, the 80s were an era of music that you kind of didn't know much about or dig into more deeply. And so why is that? And two, I can kind of see that actually through your picks. So, you know, if you look at our other, everyone else's picks, they're kind of like standard 80s fare, if you will. Besides David Bowie, but even if you think David Bowie is more like I think of him more as a 70s artist.
No one's got Let's Dance in their top three. They just, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Adam said that, Brendan, just so you.
I know. We're gonna spar.
we gotta fight over that, yeah.
but yeah, so like kind of tell me about why that was kind of a blind spot. And then what do you take out of, you know, kind of listening to, you know, all these different things? And do you still want it to be blind?
Yeah, I'm really glad you brought this up, because that was certainly my first reaction when it was announced that this was going to be our topic. It was like, oh man, I feel like this is one of my biggest blind spots musically. And then I started to look into some of my favorite records, and I've kind of made, compared to what you just said, I don't know if you'll agree, but I feel like I've realized that you guys, I love the 80s. I don't know. Like, when I think of the 80s, I think of the gated reverb sounds. I think of the synths that can have a little bit of a cheese factor to them these days. That's what first comes to mind. And so my head kind of goes to like the pop records that are still around and they just didn't hold up. And maybe it's because I'm an 80s baby, you know, like I was born and a lot of this stuff was already out there, and maybe I rejected it at birth. I don't know. But I think this was a great exercise for me to dig into that. And even though maybe some of those quintessential records did not make my top three, I have listened to a lot of that stuff in prepping for this and have a newfound love and appreciation for a lot of that stuff.
Hey, we have a breakthrough, Freddie. Ladies and gentlemen.
Hey, Freddie, millennials, yep. Millennials, right? Hey, Brendan, don't start coming to practice in any mesh shirts and like weird like line glasses. All right, don't do that.
Okay, boomer.
Oh, here we go.
You know what's funny? Actually, a memory of mine popped up on the book of Face today. That's a promo shot from 1986 of a band that I was in.
Nice.
You must share that.
You must share that.
Have 80s will travel.
Nice. All right. Today. So let me go to our picks a little bit. That was a pick that Freddie made that I was definitely going to put that in my top three if I hadn't seen that. And I think maybe Adam might have as well. So Freddie, man, tell me about that record, and what that means to you.
Are you talking about Michael? I mean, Peter Gabriel. I mean, there's such great playing on that record. It's almost virtuosic. Is that a word? Virtue.
Yeah.
Virtuosic, but not for the sake of the song. The playing is, you know, really that elevated, but it doesn't get in the way of the song, especially Manu Katché. I just want to say something about his playing.
And who is he? What is he playing?
He was a drummer.
Drummer, right.
not sure where he's from. Originally, maybe French Algerian or French African. But his playing is just so different than so musical and not your standard like backbeat 2 and 4. Hmm. But it doesn't get in the way of the song. It elevates the song. And when I first heard it, I was really confused as to how is he doing that and not ruining the song. It's right. Like he's overplaying, but he's not. So right. that was a big takeaway for me.
And pair that with help. Tony Levin. Amazing. He was such an influence on me. And in fact, I play a Music Man Stingray bass partly because of his playing on those records. Like that tone was incredible.
Right. Right. That's a good point. And one of the connections between another album when I list Daniel Lanois, Brendan, kind of tell me, is there any, can you see similarities in, I guess, the production values between, So and the Neville Brothers album that you picked?
I don't think so. I really don't. To me, they sound worlds apart. And I think that's the sign of a very versatile producer. I can definitely hear similarities between Yellow Moon and Oh Mercy, as I referenced earlier. Those are sonically to me are very much in the same world. And musically, there's a lot of crossover there too. But no, with So, to me, I will candidly admit, I didn't realize that was Lanois. And to me, it's like, very different records.
And Adam, Bob Dylan's go ahead.
Aaron. I was saying, are you familiar with that Neville Brothers album?
No, just a little surface level. No, that's definitely one that's going to be added into there. Now, I was just going to interject. You got Oh Mercy of Dylan in there. I think Lanois kind of shows that he's kind of got a lot of versatility in his production, and maybe he's just he's more maybe one of those producers that can massage the artist into their vision a little better, more than like the this is my sound guy, you know.
Right.
I think so. Right. And I think Peter Gabriel had a lot of vision too. It has a lot of vision that is undeniable. So I think that shapes the production.
I was going to say, I can't see Gabriel not having a lot of something to say about the direction that album took.
Yeah. That guy's got a big head.
And it's funny because that was like, it is a pretty large head. But if you look at all of his other albums, of Gabriel's albums, like you felt like this just time around, he's like, you know what, let me make a pop record and make a bunch of money. And then I'll go back and I'll do a soundtrack for a Passion of the Christ. You know, it's like, he's just, you know, I, that's why I admire Peter Gabriel, in the, my inner pantheon of favorites. It's just, he kind of just does whatever the hell he wants. And, you know, and he just can just keep doing it. And that's just really cool. You know, that's what, isn't that what every musician wants, is to do whatever the hell you want. And people just seem to like it, you know?
Yeah.
And by the way, that's exactly what he did. Passion was the next record after and Birdie was the one before it. Soundtrack film right here in Philadelphia.
Oh, really? Uh-huh. Birdie was Philly? Huh?
Oh, yeah. Great movie. Check it out.
Wow. So one of the, another albums that it just kind of took me by surprise on the Spotify playlist was the album Avalon by Roxy Music. And so there was a moment back, I don't know, maybe 10 years or so, where I tried to get into them and I just couldn't do it. I just thought it was just so not good. But when I approaching this album on the playlist, I was like, oh, I'm not going to like this. And then put it on, I was like, man, this is really nice. Tell me about the difference between this album and their previous albums. Like, were they trying to go for something a little more different, or tell me about
that. Well, the Roxy Music you're talking about is probably the 70s glam Roxy Music, which is
that's the one.
Miles, and I can see, knowing your taste, I can see and you not liking that, and they were, they're kind of a mix of glam and experimental then. But the first two albums, Brian Eno was in the band, and then he left to do his own thing. And when Eno left, kind of Brian Ferry started kind of taking the reins more and more and more. And they did they had four more albums without Eno before taking a little like 3-4 year hiatus. And then when they came back for Avalon, it's basically just Brian Ferry's baby at the time. So the kind of that experimentalness was kind of gone, but it was kind of replaced with songcraft and Phil Manzanera is a very, I think he's an underappreciated guitar player as well. And, in David Gilmour's touring band back when we start seeing gigs again, I mean, Phil Manzanera is around and he's done his own solo albums and, I think he plays some beautiful guitar on there. I mean, you still have some great playing. I think what you're seeing, Aaron, though, is just really the passage of time and just the evolution of an artist. Really, I think Brian Ferry probably felt he kind of got what he needed out of the the power glamour. And personally, I love all those albums too. But I mean, it's like a whole different band. It's hard to rank it amongst all those other ones because you're just like, this is a whole other thing.
Yeah, this sounds like good, and the other one sounds bad.
on the topic of the evolution of Brian Ferry, this is not 80s, but I don't know if any of you watched that show Babylon Berlin on Netflix.
Yes, Brian Ferry, I just finished it last night.
It's fantastic, and Brian Ferry contributes a lot of the songs to that show because music is a very important part of the show, like late 20s, early 30s European jazz and cabaret music. And
he actually appears in an episode. I don't know if you're that far.
Oh, yet. No, I didn't see that. No.
How far are you? How many?
I finished it.
Oh, yeah. He's the male singer at the club.
Oh, right. Performed. That's him, of course.
Wow.
That's,
yep.
Cool.
Yeah. I just finished it last night.
Nice.
The first two seasons are amazing. Third?
Yeah.
Okay.
Right.
And just to add one more point to Brian Ferry, I make my big money in the TV industry, you know, the sports, the big production trucks, and I talk music with all those guys because we hang out, have a lot of downtime, and a lot of the guys of, that are, like 15, 20 years older than me, and I talk about Roxy Music, and they are all like, oh, Avalon, it's like a lot of people, like that, a lot of like, it is, there's like two Roxy Musics as far as like... people's memories of it. And it was just interesting. That Avalon is really, it's like, it is the 80s Roxy Music. And then really that was their last album as that band. And then Ferry just kind of, this is like, okay, you know what? This is just my thing. I'm going to call it my thing. So.
All right. And, so I'm gonna take a little turn here. And talk about Herbie Hancock, for this album. I remember growing up in Philly and walking to the bus stop and hearing this, hearing it. And I was like, man, this is really cool. Where are the words? I thought it was great. But looking at our full list, this is kind of the only instrumental issue.
The most part, record. Yeah.
And, I was kind of thinking about, like, in terms of jazz. I don't know if you even can consider it jazz, but why didn't we pick any other like 80s jazz albums? Were there any good ones besides this one, or is that like not a thing?
I don't know. It's certainly a thing. There were plenty of jazz artists making records. Maybe it's just, and I think this is part of the stigma when you say music from the 80s. I think your mind goes to a very specific slice of popular culture. And I think a lot of us went there.
Yep.
But your mind didn't, man. You stay true to yourself. And
well,
that's
maybe
to be respected.
But also that Herbie album, you could hear it exactly as you described, like kind of an early hip hop dance record without any lyrics, with the exception of like the Curtis Mayfield cover.
Yeah. No, I really appreciated listening to that again. I haven't heard that in a long time. So yeah, go ahead, Adam.
And I think what you're seeing with the 80s too, especially if you put a fine tooth comb through a lot of our choices, especially on the jazz front, a lot of the jazz giants were had already passed or were in the waning years of their career, because we see between like the 50s and 60s and early 70s, there was a lot of jazz, and there wasn't quite maybe the new guard. I don't even know really the state of jazz.
That was that with the Young Lions or New Lions, Winton and the Joshua Redman. Was that, or maybe that was a little bit later.
A little later than that.
No, there's a couple good Wynton Marsalis albums from the 80s. Definitely.
Yeah, Fred Hirsch was big in the 80s, making a lot of records then.
But is it Miles Davis and John Coltrane? It's like you're in the shadows of like those guys. It's.
Well, Miles had a big 80s era. I mean, the very controversial Juju record, which I was considering on my list, but that one is so polarizing.
Yeah.
I'm surprised nobody picked Madonna.
Yeah.
Well, that's a good point, Freddie. I'm glad you brought up albums that weren't picked. Because there is a couple really glaring albums that, and I was kind of curious whether or not they made your honorable mentions list. Thinking about Madonna and her albums. I consider Madonna, except for her first one with Borderline. I love Borderline, the song. But the rest of the 80s. 80s.
That was still 80s.
Yep, but the rest of the album was garbage. Same thing for Whitney Houston's albums. There's like a couple of songs where it's like, oh man, this, the rest of the album is like throwaways. But there was a couple other ones. So for instance, I believe GNR had an
little
album
Appetite.
That nobody picked. I guess maybe that's part of our taste. Maybe we just don't fit in that realm. Or there's, I believe, wasn't Paul Simon's Graceland in the 80s?
Yes.
That was?
Yep. I was just reading this. It went up, went up against Graceland for Album of the Year, and Graceland won.
Yeah, that's a travesty because Graceland's terrible.
Come on,
Brendan.
Oh no, we're not reopening that can. But similarly, Let's Dance went up against Thriller for the Grammy, and Thriller won that year.
Well, that you can understand that.
Yeah, that's kind of understandable.
Yeah, I mean, you're going against like the greatest album, one of the greatest albums of all time, and that's saying that Let's Dance is probably like my ninth favorite Bowie album.
And then, Brendan, one of your favorites, I'm sure he had a couple of albums. I don't know specifically, but Billy Joel had a couple of albums out in the 80s that were great. I'm surprised you didn't pick one of his.
Well, we have to get down to three.
and then, of course, probably the biggest album of the 80s, none of us picked. And I was going to pick it on my list, but, you know, it just didn't make the cut. Does anybody know what that album is?
Oh, I can't think of it.
Joshua Tree. Isn't it the Joshua Tree?
Was it Robert Palmer album?
Was it Tracy Chapman?
Yes. No, it was not. I'm not a fan of Tracy Chapman.
Oh, I couldn't have. I wouldn't have guessed that. No way.
But yeah, Purple Rain. So nobody picked it. And it's a travesty, but you know, life happens and you lick your wounds and you move on.
You pick yourself up by your bootstraps and you move on.
Yeah. Sometimes you have to paint things with a different color other than purple.
Yeah, that's true.
I had a few hip hop albums that were right on the fringe too, because we have not talked about a lot of hip hop rap.
Run DMC.
That could be a separate pod. Who knows?
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. Sure.
Speaking of colors though, so we were just talking about purple. I'd like to just talk about white real quick. And so, Freddie, you picked an album. Was it White Reggae or Reggae by White People? Or what was it, the title?
Regatta de Blanc.
Regatta de Blanc. I love the Police for that. Just so you know. Tell me a little bit about this album.
I think they were finding their legs in the studio. I think heretofore they were pretty much slogging it out in the bars and the clubs and, you know, riding off of Roxanne. And I think the second album is where they really hunkered down in the studio and said, all right, let's see what we can do here. I've actually read where Stuart Copeland says that this is his favorite Police album.
Hmm. And I think Synchronicity was their really, really big one from the 80s. Is that correct?
Synchronicity.
Yeah.
They had kind of mastered the studio by that point, I guess.
Yeah.
I guess. Yeah.
I was kind of surprised that wasn't on anyone's picks, actually.
Yeah, me too. One that I'll just throw one of my honorable mentions in there. And before that, I realized I misspoke. Miles Davis's Tutu album, not Juju. That's Wayne Shorter. Tutu is a very controversial record. If you don't know it, it's your boy Marcus Miller produced it.
Yeah. I read all about that.
I have a lot of love for Tutu. But anyway, one of my honorable mentions, which I wanted to put on my list, but amazingly, it's not on Spotify for whatever reason. Tom Waits, Rain Dogs. Great record.
Mm. Rain Dogs is on Spotify. Yeah.
It's not. Check it out.
It certainly is. No, I know it is. I bet you $1.
Oh, $1. We're going to take $1 on that.
And I'll Venmo you $1 if you're right.
It's not. There's a curated playlist. Other people that include Rain Dogs. There's three Rain Dogs songs from the album proper. I don't know why that is, but the whole record's not on there.
Wow. That's something.
But that's 1985.
There's an album of somebody playing Tom Waits' Rain Dogs solo piano.
maybe that's what he was referring to.
did I get to keep my dollar? I swear, you know what? I swear it's been on there recently. That's weird. It's not.
Anymore. Yeah, I mean, contracts always can get adjusted and rights change. No, whatever.
I had a little Tom Waits thing a couple months ago, and I definitely listened to Rain Dogs on there. That's weird. Yeah, something they got pulled. That's a bummer. Yeah. That's what kills me. Like De La Soul isn't on Spotify, and that kills me. That hurts me every day.
Well, let me go to one something that doesn't kill you. That Kate Bush album, Hounds of Love. I never heard it really. It's awesome. It is like super, seems to me experimental. I'm just really a huge fan of hers now. Like, I had to be older to listen to her, because she wasn't, you know, Madonna or, any of my picks, Janet Jackson, that Control album or anything like that, but she has her own lane and she's really something special.
Yeah. She doesn't quite have the flash of those pop starlets, you know what I mean? It's not quite the thing. And really, if you listen to her now you listen to like where the female vocalists have gone since her, you're like, oh, this is where, you know, I wonder how Tori Amos got her, you know, where she got her inspiration from. I wonder no more, you know, and just, I don't know. And I can't say I'm a massive fan of much more of her catalog, though I have to dig a little deeper, but I'm like, I don't know how you improve upon that. You know what I mean?
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. One of my picks, or two of my picks. Did you guys listen to that album Night and Day by Joe Jackson at all? Or
I got it on vinyl.
I've heard it in the past.
But it's not anything that you've dug into at all. On a serious level. Any of you guys, Brandon? No.
No, only on your suggestion. You had referenced it in something we were working on a while back. So I listened to it and liked it.
Same here. Yeah. Same here. Yeah. I gave it a few spins. But
Stepping Out was a huge hit.
Huge. Breaking Us in Two.
Yeah.
Breaking Us in Two. Yeah, that was a big hit.
Yeah. Yep. Exactly. Yeah,
that was a really great And then just one more honorable mention from me that I was going to think about was that Rhythm Nation from Janet Jackson. I was actually thinking about putting that album. It came out in 1989. I was actually going to consider putting that album in above Control, except for we go back to one of our previous pods. The stupid skits. The skits really just like did it in. Like, I don't think anybody should ever have any skits in their albums. That's just my
statement. It never goes well.
I can't think of one skit where I'm like, yo, I am so glad they put that skit in there. Like, I can't think of any. Freddie.
Nothing dates an album faster.
Are you a skit guy?
I've heard certain hip-hop albums that start with a skit, which I think maybe works more than other genres.
Hmm.
You know what I mean?
Well, you got to send me those songs, because, man, I'm out on a skit. So if you guys ever think about putting a skit in one of our songs, I'm out.
Or we're out, either or.
So I think we're about to close up now, but I just wanted to kind of throw it out to see if you guys had any other thoughts about the 80s albums or the music of the 80s that in listening to the playlist or listening to our discussion, that any other remaining thoughts that you might have. Adam?
Now, as always with these playlists that are available on Spotify as well, I keep them with me, and I like to spin them on random, or like what I do each week. I take the ones that I don't know as well, like the Neville Brothers and Janet Jackson, and I add them into my mix, because I think as I push the point home every time, anytime I can, is you need to give any album some time. If you give the album some time, you might find an ear for something you didn't quite know you did.
Speaking of Adam, that Elvis Costello Imperial Bedroom album, I never heard it. I've always hated with the passion Elvis Costello, but I did not hate this that much. I was like, okay,
that's why I brought it into this. It's a very, that's one of the most, because yeah, his voice has a certain a nasal hate quality me, hate to me it.
Quality,
yes, and I get that, and I get that a lot. I'm a huge fan, but I can understand why people wouldn't. But the production value in this one, this was my bridge. This was my bridge, anyone's possible bridge to Elvis Costello.
I could definitely see that. That was a good pick. But going back to the kind of overall theme, Brendan, do you have any kind of
thoughts on that? I have thoughts, and I have a question for you guys too. Like for me, just music from the 80s is such a clearly demarcated entity, and it's almost like quite literally like 1990 hits and music just starts to sound completely different. And I don't know why that is for me, but I've always just like compartmentalized music from the 80s in a certain box. And I'm trying to open that box more, but I just wonder if you guys have felt the same way or if you don't see those boundaries the same way.
What do you think, Freddie?
Concerning that demarcation, maybe as a result of people reacting to how identifiable the 80s record sound, especially in concerning drum sounds, etc. Maybe that was a reaction to the 80s by going away from those sounds purposely to mark the beginning of a new decade. It's the only thing I can think of. Does that make sense?
Yeah, definitely. The one thing I can also think about is the 80s were a time when music videos came to popularity. And so not only are you hearing the songs, but you're visually seeing them, and you're visually seeing them. I know I had it on all day long. And so like they just pounded you into the ground. Like the 80s. That identifiable 80s sound just kept pounding you into the ground in the car, in your tape deck,
commercials.
On commercials, yeah. On the and it was a combination also of the music and the art. I was just looking at some video where there's this design firm called Memphis, based in like Italy, and they kind of were in charge of that 80s look. And just everything was just like glopped together and just like pounding over the head over and over in like every sort of medium.
Yeah.
Whether it be, like I said, like radio, TV, design, it was just pounding.
Fashion. Yeah. Even color schemes.
Fashion, sure. Color schemes.
Yeah.
Put all together, at least in my theory, is that, it kind of just really defined the 80s as a thing. And it also defined the 90s as a reaction to the 80s.
Yeah.
And actually, thinking about the disco era, I think the 80s were somewhat of a minor reaction to that as well. Not really a reaction as like of disgust as the 90s were to the 80s, but in a kind of similar like, yeah, we're going to party, but we're going to party more fashionably now.
Well, I one thing I wanted to mention I just crossed my mind is the influence of punk music, because taking the music, the what was happening in London and in New York in the mid to late 70s, punk as a reaction to maybe disco or, you know, slick, you know, prog rock, you know, whatever. Yeah. I think that when some marketing guys created the term new wave, it was a way to like legitimize punk, and therefore that helped, for better or for worse, shape the 80s as well in terms of the angularity of fashions and colors and
right,
you know, things being a little askew.
Right.
And for the same kind of reasonings you were saying, Brendan, with the demarcation thing, I think, and with all the media, I think, I mean, the 90s reacting to the 80s, I mean, there's the first like mass thing of media, like maybe the backlash is stronger. It just stands out as being stronger. You know what I mean? Just because of, it's the first major like push back from like so much stuff. And yeah, I don't know. I mean, things are so homogenized now that I don't like, you see like the 2010s giving the middle finger to the 2000s. I'm like, eh. Not really.
I mean, I don't see it. I just see it all as the same. But maybe that's my I've been off the train.
That's so climbing. That's climbing the summit of Mount Cynical. Yes.
And on that note, everyone, thanks for listening to another The Right Fiction. A Right Fiction podcast about the 80s. We'll have another great pop for you next week. So stay tuned for another show. Take care.